Hello everyone, I am Jessica Saxton, the Environmental Education Outreach Leader through United Communities AmeriCorps and the host of Living Downstream. Umpqua Watersheds values both human and ecological diversity. We acknowledge that the land upon which Umpqua Watersheds is located was formerly occupied and tended by various indigenous groups, including Cow Creek Umpqua, Coquille, Mulala, and others. Their history is intertwined with this place, and we seek to continue to practice stewardship and reciprocity towards the natural environment which indigenous people did for thousands of years prior to European settlement. We celebrate the strengths and perspectives that different people have to offer, and believe that organizations, communities, and ecosystems are all more resilient when they embrace the unique gifts various individuals can contribute.
Welcome. Joining us today, I have Lakia Burnside Atkinson from UCAN AmeriCorps here with me today. Thank you for joining me.
Yeah, today thanks for having me, Jessica.
Yeah, today we will be discussing what you have been focusing on since joining UCAN AmeriCorps. So would you like to introduce yourself and provide a bit of information about who you are?
Yeah, my name's Lakia, as you said. I've lived in Douglas County my whole life. I'm a mother of two, a college student, and a lover of the outdoors.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah, of course.
So what is your host site? Where do you serve at? And what kind of services do you provide?
So I am currently serving at Umpqua Community College as the Multicultural Resource Facilitator. I'm connecting students to different resources inside of and outside of our community.
Awesome. Wonderful. Do you enjoy your position?
I do enjoy my position. I absolutely love it here. It's beautiful. It's so beautiful. I was just outside listening to the birds and watching the squirrels and listening to the river. And I enjoy the culture of the college and what I do and the interactions I have and the connections I make here. It's wonderful.
I agree. I definitely enjoy spending time on campus, just walking around and enjoying the birds and the beautiful scenery. Yeah. So what inspired you to serve with UCAN AmeriCorps?
Well, Jessica, what inspired me to serve with AmeriCorps was, first of all, the desire to grow professionally and to serve in my community. Also, the chance to make a little bit of money, being a mom at home with a 3-year-old and an 11-year-old. It was a challenge for me to find somewhere that I could grow professionally and make a little bit of money and be of service with my kids at home. So AmeriCorps actually helps pay for my son's childcare, which makes it all possible. Also, at the end of my service term, I can potentially receive a scholarship.
That is some great benefits to serving with AmeriCorps, that's for sure. Yeah. So let's talk about what you have been working on since starting your service term.
Yeah. So some things that I've been working on since starting my service term here at UCC, I've created a multicultural club, and we have been putting on like events here on campus, developing life skills workshops, identifying community resources, which helps students overcome barriers, developing health and wellness activities, and engaging students in diversity, equity, and inclusion work.
Awesome. That sounds like a lot of great projects you've been working on.
Yeah, it's never dull, something to do, and so diverse.
Yeah, and I'm assuming you had a part in planning and hosting the Earth Day event at UCC.
Oh, yes, that was so wonderful. I was able to help facilitate and plan an Earth Day event here on campus, just honoring our wonderful Earth that we live on and ways to support our Earth. So we brought in a couple artists from the community, Max Schmute with One Leg Frog Art Studio, Community Art Studio in downtown Roseburg, and Jasmine Valencia. We also had Umpqua Watersheds there and Umpqua Valley Beekeepers Association and Umpqua Valley Master Gardeners. We had a bunch of fun activities. We created upcycled art together. There was even an obstacle course. I'm really bummed I missed it.
That was a lot of fun to watch. The students seemed to really get into it.
Yeah, it was a beautiful day.
Yeah.
Everyone was just buzzing, as the Umpqua Valley Beekeepers Association might say.
I know. And they even had free bees, which was so cool.
What?
Yeah, I
Oh,
know.
I had
Yeah,
to dip out early during it, but
they weren't there, but he gave some information that he'll give you a freebie. You can get started on your B box, and he talked me through it and everything. It was really cool.
that is really cool.
Yeah. Well, that was a great event, and I definitely enjoyed being there. It was great to be out in the sun. So what's your favorite project or experience during your service term?
So, my favorite project so far is being able to start the student-led multicultural club. It has grown to over 30 members since January 27th, I want to say. The richness of the varying cultures and the building of relationships on campus and with the community has just been so wonderful. I've grown so much during my service term professionally and as an individual. So those are some of my favorite things that I've been kind of working on here at the UCC.
That's amazing. What does the multicultural club do?
So it's a group of students that get together and they share about their culture. And we usually have food. We had a member come in and she actually brought her Hispanic dancing skirt and she danced and we made salsa, or she made salsa, and we made guacamole together and we talked about music. We've had corned beef and cabbage for St. Patrick's Day. We talked about what St. Patrick's Day is really about and how it came to be. Then we talked about Ireland, and some history there. We had sushi. We made sushi rolls as a club. And we're planning future events too here on campus. So just connecting with so many people with so much rich background and diversity, it's just been really cool to build those connections and make friendships with people.
Wonderful. Yeah, that sounds like a lot of fun. Out of curiosity, do you have to be a college student to participate in this?
So it is a student-led club, though there are staff and faculty that do show up. And if a club member wants to bring in their kids with them so they can attend, they won't be turned away at all. Everybody's welcome.
That's awesome. Do you have any fun upcoming activities with the club?
Well, we are actually having a club meeting this Friday, and we will be celebrating Cinco de Mayo, or at least learning about Cinco de Mayo and what that actually is and how it came to be. We'll be having asada street tacos, and yeah, it's going to be really cool.
That's awesome. Do you have any other upcoming events or volunteer opportunities that, students or the community might be able to get involved in?
Well, I'm glad you asked, Jessica. Yes, we do. We're having a career after college event on May 24th. So, different organizations that have careers for students after college will be here on campus on May 24th. That's from 11 until 2. And also, we have Party Like a Hawk Star on June 2nd, which is the end of the year student celebration. The multicultural club, will be participating in that at some capacity once we figure out what we're going to do. I think it has to do with cultural foods, though. Everybody loves food. And also on June 16th, it's graduation.
That's
Yeah,
exciting.
so exciting.
Awesome. That sounds like a lot of fun upcoming events. So, have you been enjoying your service term since, you started, and what are your plans for afterwards?
Yeah, so I'm beyond thrilled about my service term, and how it's been going. It would be sad if my service term was ending, but I'm sticking around for another year here at UCC with AmeriCorps.
That's awesome. I'm excited for you.
Yeah, I'm super excited. It's just such a joy to be here.
It sounds like it. So, do you have any fun facts or information you'd like to share with the audience?
Well, as I was thinking about this question, I came up with a couple. Did you know that there are hiking trails here on campus, Jessica?
Oh, I did.
And some locals actually call them the hidden gems of our area.
I did not know that.
And
Wow.
did you know that there are over 19 countries represented here at UCC from past and present international students?
That's incredible.
Yeah. So there are opportunities to travel internationally and become a student elsewhere as well. So I didn't
Oh.
even know that was a thing really until I came here and seen everybody, participating in being a student elsewhere. So I thought that was pretty cool.
So, how does that work? I mean, is it, do you like do a year somewhere else?
So I'm not sure exactly how it works. I just know that there are tons of students from other countries here on campus, and it seems like they're really enjoying their time here, and I've learned a lot from them. I also met with a student who is planning to travel to Korea to become an international student there. So if you want any more information than that and how to get involved in that, just call UCC and they'll direct you right where to go.
That's cool. Yeah, thank you for that information.
Of
Those are
course.
some great opportunities to go and explore different countries. And it's great that, we're a host school for other countries. Yeah,
Yeah.
that's amazing. Do you have anything else you want to add?
No, but if anybody's interested in joining AmeriCorps, I believe people are signing up to join AmeriCorps right now. Just go on to the AmeriCorps website and see what opportunities are there and see if it fits your lifestyle and what you're looking for. It's really a great program. It's helped me grow so much. And yeah. And if you want
Yeah.
to become a student or further your education, talk to UCC. If you want to stay local and come to a beautiful school and grow in your desired career, it's a good place to start.
And they have so many clubs too, which is amazing.
Yes, they do.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Lakia, for joining us today on this episode of Living Downstream.
Yeah, thank
And
you for
thank
having me, Jessica. It's been really great.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for sharing all this information.
You're welcome.
Joining us today, I have Luisa de Amico Arlinson from UCAN AmeriCorps here with us today. Thank you for joining me. Today, we will be discussing what you've been focusing on since joining UCAN AmeriCorps. Would you like to introduce yourself and provide a bit of information?
Yeah, hi. My name is Louisa. I use she, her pronouns. I grew up in central New Jersey. I went to school in Vermont and studied biological sciences and got two minors in chemistry and pharmacology. My trajectory at that point in time, I really wanted to be a physical therapist. And then my senior year came along and something changed in my mind, and I was just more plant oriented. So after I graduated, I moved to Washington State last year for my first year of AmeriCorps, teaching an adult gardening class. And that's kind of where I started thinking about, maybe I want to do something in like this realm. So now I'm here in Roseburg, Oregon, and happy to be here.
Awesome. I'm glad to have you. I hope you're enjoying the Oregon climate. Yeah.
100%. It's so nice.
So, who do you serve with? Where's your host site and what type of services do you provide?
Yeah, my host site is Umpqua Valley Farm to School. We provide garden education to elementary school students. So my title is school garden coordinator. So like I said, teaching students the power and joy of interacting with where their food comes from. So my main service that I provide is teaching in-class education to pre-K to fifth grade, from anything about like the bugs that live in our soil, about like flowers, about how like we can be advocates of change. I also do like garden recess. So if kids are outside during recess and I am there at the school, they can come out and we can look for snails, we can talk, we can just like sit in the garden. I'm also present in like the lunchroom and just making sure that everyone's like choosing healthy choices, encouraging them to eat everything off of their plate. And on top of all of that, I also tend to the garden myself. I coordinate work parties with community members, and I also participate in like field trips to local farms.
Wow, that sounds like you do a lot.
It's a lot, but it is very fulfilling, and it's all interconnected. Always keeping me on my toes, and with kids, like there's never a dull moment. So I do it for them.
That's so true. So this sounds like this is your second year with UCAN AmeriCorps.
Last year, I was with Washington State.
Okay. So what inspired you to serve here in Oregon with UCAN AmeriCorps?
Yeah. So, what took me to just AmeriCorps in general, I knew that I wanted to be an AmeriCorps volunteer since like my freshman year of high school. My parents were Peace Corps volunteers, and they kind of engraved in me like the power of serving our community. I was also like a Girl Scout, so like that just in my mind was like, oh yeah. And then after college, I was just like, well, I don't really know what to do. I kind of just want to like be in a community, have different jobs. And so that's how I got to Washington. And then, I was just looking at a lot of different jobs with elementary school students and like gardens. And this one just stood out to me. I visited once before moving here and I really enjoyed it. I saw wild turkeys, I saw the hills. Like, I was like, this is a good place. And then my supervisor, I saw the passion that she had. So I was like, yeah, like, I want to be a part of that too.
That's awesome. So, what have you been working on? I mean, we kind of talked a little bit about what you've been doing. Is there any like favorite projects or experiences during your service term that you'd want to share?
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said before, lots going on. So the joy of just being in a classroom and just like interacting with the kids. One of my favorite things is all the kids call me like Garden Lady. So I'll just be walking through the school, and it's hard to like remember all like I work at two schools actually, Fir Grove and Winchester Elementary. And it's hard to remember like 800 students' names. So I just kind of like peace sign, hey, how's it going? Like, I'm Garden Lady. Yeah, I think the field trips are really awesome because not only like does it get like the kids out to the farms, like I'm not like a local person. So like it's a great way for me to like see these farms and the projects that are going on with them. I have hosted like three garden clubs at this point, and I really enjoy that, getting kids just like excited about the garden, excited about talking about things like why they're interested in like the environment. But one of the biggest things that I have been working on is composting during Fir Grove's lunch. And this has been really awesome because like I can be present during their lunch telling them, hey, like we're feeding our bodies, we're not feeding like the trash can. We're feeding our bodies, we're not feeding the worms that are going to be eating the food in the compost bin. And then getting them to like challenge their brains of like what can go into the compost bin. Look at your plate, look at your tray, see what is plastic and see what is like food. So even like a few days ago, they had like clementines in the lunchroom, and like some kids were like, can this go into the like compost bin? I'm like, yeah, it's a food. We don't eat the food, but the worms will eat the food. And then the biggest challenge of that is like the kids sometimes are like, yeah, I'm gonna like feed the worms. And it's like, no, we're using the worms to our advantage. They're gonna be eating the food that like we don't eat. But like we wanna limit our food waste.
That's amazing. I love composting, and I'm so glad you're teaching it, to kids, the next generation. That's really good and it'll be helpful. Yeah. Do you guys use the compost or do you have plans to use it?
So this is in partnership with Heal Terra, which is the vermicompost facility in Roseburg. And they provide the buckets for us. And they pick it up and they sort through it, make sure that there's no like plastic utensils or anything like that in there. And then they feed it to their worms. And you can buy compost from them.
Wow, that's amazing. I'd love to see more schools in the area composting after lunch rather than just throwing it away.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's where I feel really grateful to be in this position because Fir Grove is the first school that they are starting with. So it's kind of just like a pilot project. And to be able to like figure out all of the problems that are like coming up with it and how to find a solution to them, is that's the thing that I really like, the problem solving.
That is amazing. I love problem solving as well. So it definitely sounds like you've been busy, and we only have a few months left in our service terms. So are you sad it's coming to an end? Are you going to be sticking around for maybe another year?
Yeah, I have been very much enjoying my service term, and being in the school with the kids. I am sad that it is coming to end, but after being an AmeriCorps for 2 years, I am also just like excited to be like, okay, like I did this. And that proudness inside of me is like very much there. So it's like a little bit bittersweet. I don't exactly know what my plans are like after this term. I am just definitely interested in anything outdoor education, serving youth, serving the earth, serving a community. And I have so many interests that I'm really just like feeling it out. So just like how I got this job, I'm just gonna find positions and see what kind of falls into my lap and what feels the best within me.
I like it. I think that's a good experience. And you gain so much knowledge being able to try out all these different positions and work with different communities. So I can empathize with that. I don't know what the next year brings for me as well, but I hope maybe, in the next year or two, I'd get to serve again somewhere different.
Yeah, and a big believer in just like not rushing it and not forcing it and just like seeing what happens. Like that's like how I got this position. I was like, this felt the best, and I actually second guessed it for a really long time, and then I ultimately was like, well, this was the first thing that my brain told me I should do. And so I'm running with that for this next year. But I'm going to be doing like summer camps until August. So I have a little bit more time after my like service term ends to kind of figure things out, which I'm like truly grateful for.
Nice. Do you have any like upcoming events or trainings or volunteer opportunities that, kids or the residents might be able to get involved in?
Absolutely. Umpqua Valley Farm to School is always looking for volunteers. A project that like I'm in search of someone for is someone to help out with the composting at Fir Grove. If anyone has availability for maybe like an hour from like 11:40 to 12:40, or even like a half an hour at the beginning of that or at the end of that, just like supervising compost, like tape bringing the buckets out, putting the buckets back, because the one challenge with that is just this, the sustainability, not making more work for the people who already work there and already have jobs that this is not for them. So that would be the biggest thing. I have some upcoming projects that I don't have dates for. At Winchester Elementary, we are building a greenhouse, and that's in the works. And at Fir Grove, we're also going to be building new garden beds. So if anyone is interested in that, my email is louisa@uvf2s.org. And then like I'm not the only one who uses like volunteers. I have a counter part who is at two other elementary schools. She's always in use. We have like on our webpage a place where you can sign up for our newsletter and like reach out to us if like, hey, I just want to be in a garden. Like put me on a mailing list, and if we have a work day, we will email you.
That's awesome. That sounds like a lot of great opportunities to get involved. Out of curiosity, what time is the lunch for the composting?
The composting, it is at the first lunch starts at 11:40, and the last lunch ends at 12:40.
And would you need someone every day?
We wouldn't need someone every day. If we could get multiple people during a week, so we have a person every day, that would be cool. But also like this is in the middle of the day, and like I recognize that people work. once a week, twice a week, like just anyone to show up, it would be like so helpful. Especially like I'm at the schools bi-weekly. So 1 week I'm at Fir Grove, the next I'm at Winchester, and then back and forth. The weeks that I'm not there, that's when I hear from the staff, hey, we're having a little bit of an issue. The kids will do the composting. We have kids monitoring the compost buckets, but then all of it is left out. So even if you do like at like 12:40, come by 10 minutes, just clean up the buckets, put them outside, that would be the most helpful.
Awesome. Thank you for sharing that. I hope you find a volunteer and, you know, maybe if I have time available, reach out to you.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Thank you.
So do you have any other information or fun facts you'd like to share with the audience?
Yeah. So with the composting, and just like the field trips and everything I teach, the one thing that like I continuously teach is about worms. And I love just getting kids in the garden, like looking at worms. So I have a few worm fun facts. One is that worms can actually live up to 10 years, which like I had no idea. and they can eat half of their body weight in a day.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So we have like worm compost buckets that I like bring to field trips or to classes, and like we feed them with food waste. So like a pound of worms can eat a half a pound of food per day, which
that's crazy.
Astonishing. And then they poop it all out and it's like great for our garden. So like, And then something recently that I learned, because some of the kids were asking me about like why the worms were like so sticky and slimy and all of that. Worms breathe out of their skin. They have no lungs. That's why they need to stay moist. But something else that's really cool about worms is that like the slime associated with like earthworms contains nitrogen, which is like plant food itself. So even by just like the worms like going through the ground, they're leaving like little residue of the slime that then just like the plants eat.
That's really cool.
And one more for you. This one.
Yeah.
This one was weird because I had been teaching about like the life cycle of a worm and the reproductive systems of it. And at one of my garden clubs, actually, we were building a worm bin, and a student found like a little like sack of some sort. They were like, "What is this?" And I was like, "I don't know. Like, let's just like look at it." And he like popped it, and there was a baby worm that came out of it. And so I was like, huh. And I did some research on it, and baby worms actually like hatch from little tiny cocoons. And the worms have this like part of them called the clitellum, which like indicates whether it's like a mature worm, and they like shed it off, and then it like encloses like the eggs. And like, that is the little cocoon sac that like hatched.
Gosh, that's so cool.
Which like, yeah, I was like, I didn't really realize that worms cocooned or like, yeah, had that kind of like aspect to them, but mystery is within our world.
So do you know what the ring on some worms, there's like a ring around them?
Yeah.
What is that?
The like rectangle ringy kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
That is the clitellum.
Okay.
Yeah, so like stereotypical worm is like segmented. You have all those little like segments on it. And then you have a segment that's like really large.
Yeah.
That is where the eggs come from. And that's the part that like slips off of the worm, like sheds off of the worm.
Do they have to find a mate to reproduce?
They do not have to. They can, but they can also just do it themselves.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. I also know that worms helps to facilitate airflow with all their little tunnels they dig. So that definitely helps with air and water when we water our plants. So that's really nice. I compost, and then I take everything from the composter and put it in my gardens and use it for my plants, and they love it. So yes, very important. Do you have anything else you want to add?
No, that's all I got. Thank you for listening to my little like worm spiel.
Yeah, I found it really cool. So, well, thank you for joining us on this episode of Living Downstream. And I hope you
enjoy the summer and wish you success in this next year.
Yeah, thank you so much, Jessica. Happy to be on.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Living Downstream. And now, a special segment brought to you by Green Teacher.
Green Teacher's main office is located on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, Huron-Wendat, Haudenosaunee, and Mississauga peoples. This territory is covered by the Williams Treaty.
If the textbook has something to offer, we'll bring it out, but I don't use them because they usually are based much more on what I call indoor science. The students liked the walks. They call them web walks, and they liked them even when the weather conditions were inclement. That was okay with them. They wanted to go outside. And so if I have to give some suggestions to teachers about taking students outside, number one, get to know your own campus. Teachers have said to me, I would love to take my students outside, but I don't know what's going on out there. And I would say back to them, well, learn along with your students.
Testing, testing. Hey, I'm Ian.
And I'm Sophia.
And welcome to Talking with Green Teachers.
This is the Environmental Education Podcast, where we discuss recent developments, big ideas, and creative approaches to teaching green. In this episode,
they thought I should be teaching more cellular biology as an example of being more college prep. And I admitted that, yeah, when I'm taking students outside and I'm showing them mushrooms and animal tracks and so forth, there's not going to be a lot of questions on their, on their exam for getting a scholarship to college. But I believe what I was teaching may not be college prep, but it is life prep. And
early autumn in the North Woods has plenty of summer woven into its ever-changing fabric. Wildflowers abound, even if spring and summer blooms have given way to late-season asters and goldenrods. Sunlit mornings are marked by dew-covered spider webs dotting the landscape. Naturalist author and retired teacher Larry Weber taught phenology-based science for 25 years in Duluth, Minnesota, and his school year always began with explorations of nature in early autumn. Larry joined Ian to discuss the benefits of phenology-based teaching, how he structured his learning lessons, and what educators can do to be more responsive to local nature.
I might be breaking rule number one of being a host by sort of getting off track before we even get into it, but when we talked a couple days ago, you were really enthusiastic about talking spiders. So I thought, let's start with spiders before we get into phenology. And maybe some added context, there's so many different versions of Spider-Man out right now, but you kind of are like the living incarnation of Spider-Man, and you just held up the second edition of your book, Spiders of the North Woods. So tell us a bit about spiders, your spider story.
No, Spider-Man has been taken, and so I don't even try to have that label. I like a couple other labels. I like web watcher
nice.
As being one, or spider speaker. I like those two. However, I am, I'm just interested in them. I think this came from our earlier conversation. I realized that it's a topic that is usually overlooked. And I think, why? I mean, this is not a critter that's rare. They're very common. And yet most people know very little about them. And what they do know is usually what you get from the news somewhere, which is not too pleasant.
No.
I thought we should see the other side of it. And so that's what it is all about.
And your book, Spiders of the North Woods, was a book that sort of filled a gap in the world of field guides. There weren't really that many accessible guides to spiders. It was very limited.
Yeah.
And that was certainly my first spider book, and you've gone on to publish a second edition. So it's maybe starting to stick, a bit of momentum.
Well, I like to think so. And then the Web Watcher book has probably been more accepted than the earlier Spider one. The Spider of the North Woods book, the idea of that was to recognize the spider. You're seeing the spider, you photographed it, you caught it, or you're just watching it, and you can use the book to help to recognize it. The second book, Web Watcher, the idea was there that you can recognize the spider without even seeing it, just by seeing the web. And the webs are different with different spiders. In that introduction of that book, I make a comparison to maybe you know somebody, or maybe you would do this yourself. You can hear a bird, you can hear the song, and without even seeing it, you know what it is. And the same thing with, you got plenty of snow there. Same thing with getting out, seeing animal tracks in the snow.
Oh, yes.
You can recognize what they are without ever seeing the critter. Well, I thought the same idea could apply to spiders. We can see the web. No need to be concerned about seeing the spider. You can see the web and you can still tell what it is. And so that's essentially what I did in the web watching book.
I think my favorite type of web is the bowl and doily structure. Either that or funnel webs. Those two are pretty neat.
Oh, yes. Yeah, we had some fog this week. And when we have fog this close to Lake Superior, we get fog quite a lot as we get later into summer. And we had some fog this week. And during my walk, I found literally hundreds of webs.
Wonderful.
They get the dewdrops on of them from the fog. So they're highly photogenic, even though the critter itself is not that much appreciated. The webs are highly photogenic.
Oh, they're absolutely beautiful. Mm-hmm. And that dovetails nicely to our broader discussion today about phenology and phenology-based teaching, and looking at spider webs, particularly in late summer and fall, is one of the great highlights as you're learning about nature through the year. Let's start off with a definition of phenology for those who are unfamiliar with it.
I am glad to hear you pronounce it phenology. That's the same thing I do. Most people don't. Most people pronounce it phenology.
Uh-huh.
And the reason I started pronouncing it phenology is because I found too many people were misunderstanding what I was saying. And they were referring to various kinds of words that, like fin, as in studying fins of a fish, or something like that. So no, phenology is the way I pronounce it. Definition, it's essentially studying the changes that nature goes through in the course of a year, the cycle of the seasons. I tell people that we live phenology, a big part of our life. We're always living it. We change the coats, we deal with different sports, whatever it is, we live phenology. We just don't usually call it by that name.
True. It's not a super common term, and it's not particularly common in a lot of teaching contexts, yet you've certainly used it in your teaching. So sort of walk us through your framework for phenology-based teaching.
Okay. The idea was that we study nature as we go through the whole school year. I have the opportunity to be with the same group of students from the 1st of September to the 1st of June. And there's going to be a lot of changes that go through those seasons, and we are going to study it. We're going to take a closer look at all the changes that go through the whole school year. And that's essentially what I did. It's kind of interesting. I must have taught phenology-based science for at least 5 years before I even used the word.
Wow.
And even then, after I started teaching it, I rarely use the word in the classroom. And the reason for that is by the time the children I teach, 12 or 13 years old, by the time I see them, they think of science as being nothing but a bunch of big words. And I said, okay, let's keep vocabulary to the minimum. And so, yes, it's phenology-based science, but I don't use the word phenology with them very often.
And what are the benefits of this type of approach? Because it is somewhat cutting edge, even though it's really just paying attention to natural phenomena.
What are the benefits? The benefits are it's just there's something happening every day. It's just a very exciting way of teaching.
Mm.
There's always changes. There's always something to see in nature.
Always.
By late autumn, the blooming season has ended, and the landscape is cloaked with muted grays and browns. On especially frigid mornings, there might be a thin cover of snow, sprinkled with the tracks of attendant animals.
What are the key guiding principles of your teaching?
Number one is that we don't use a textbook. I am not opposed to textbooks. If the textbook has something to offer, we'll bring it out. But I don't use them because they usually are based much more on what I call indoor science. Okay, we don't use a textbook. Number two, we study nature phenology. We study it throughout the entire school year. And number three, we go outside on a regular basis throughout the school year. I taught in Duluth, Minnesota, which is known for climatic conditions in winter that aren't too pleasant.
Cold.
And we went outdoors every week of the school year. In 25 years of teaching this phenology based, I think I can count on one hand the number of times we had to cancel the walks. We would go anyway. If we couldn't go, we typically would go on Wednesday. If something happened on Wednesday and we couldn't go, then we would go on Thursday. But we would still go. We would still go every week.
Did you ever get any flack for not having a textbook?
Not really flack for not having a textbook. I got flack for a few other things, but not so much for the textbook.
Yeah. In terms of your typical week, I'm just so curious, and I think our listeners will be really interested in just what your week looks like. I mean, you've mentioned that you try to get outside at least once a week, typically on a Wednesday. What was built around that?
Okay. Now, there's a couple of caveats here. Number one is not all weeks are 5 days. Number two, not all topics that we choose to study are going to go through 5 days. Some will stretch for maybe 10 days.
Sure.
But if you could stick with just the 5 days, I broke up the school year into 30 different topics that we would look at in the course of the year. These topics were pertinent to what was going on in nature at that time. On Monday, I would start off, first thing would be, what did you see over the weekend? And this was what we called critter news. And we had to follow a few rules. Number one, it has to be something that was live. It was not on TV, okay? And you know, a lot of the kids had trouble with that. Number two, it had to be something that was wild. Okay. Next, it had to be something that was fairly close to where we were, not, you know, a weekend trip that took them a couple hundred miles away. That doesn't count. All right. We followed these rules and it took a little while, but they got really good at it. They started saying, I saw a crow. I saw a eagle. I saw, you know, a fox or something like that. And we would keep track of them. If something was mentioned that we were not too sure of, we would bring out, as I said, we didn't have a textbook, but we did use golden guides in the classroom. We would bring out the golden guides and we would look up what was said. That was on Monday. Sometimes on Monday, they would bring in critters that they caught over the weekend and we would examine those. Also on Monday, I would introduce the new topic. Mostly this was done with just some illustrations. A good example is mushrooms. I always started the school year with mushrooms. Now tell me, in your own education in middle school, how much did you learn about mushrooms?
Very little.
Well, it's getting a lot of notoriety right now, but not so much within schools. It's mostly with adult groups and classes and so forth, but not in schools. And so I would start off with it. The students just absolutely loved it. This was something they saw. This was something that was right in their yard. They had very much familiarity with it, but they didn't really know it that well. So we would start off with that. And I would make an illustration of a quote, typical mushroom, naming some of the different parts. And then I would follow that. That's Monday. We introduced the topic. On Tuesday, I would use various means. Usually it was my own photography slideshows. If I were teaching now, I would probably use some photos from internet and so forth, but I didn't have that back then. I had to make my own. Anyway, I would show them different pictures of different kinds of, I called it mushrooms and other fungi. And then we would look at those and talk about what things to look at. And many times there were things that, yes, the students were familiar with. Then we would go on Wednesday and we would take a walk. And the topic was Whatever we were looking for, that's what we would go out to see. We also combined weather conditions. When we stepped outside, I'd always say, okay, what do you think the temperature is? And then we had a thermometer nearby that we would check and other weather conditions. And then we would go out, walk, and find as much as we could in the course of the walk. On Thursday, I always believed in doing some sort of a follow-up of what we found. The students, during our walk, the students would keep notebooks. It was a structured walk. It was school. They had notebooks. They had to keep track of what we found. And it was run with a series of various rules. If you're familiar with Duluth, Minnesota, we not only have cold, we also have some sloping hills. And in the winter, we can get snow and ice. And so I had to put down some rules like no running on these conditions and stuff like that. These middle school students want to run to everything they go see. So anyway, we had to have a few rules like such. And then Thursday, we would pretty much follow up what we did on the walk and so forth. And then on Friday, students were to hand in a written report about our walk. And then some sort of an evaluation would take place on Friday. The evaluations were often questions. I would show them a picture and I'd ask them some questions about the particular fungus or particular topic, whatever we were looking at. That's the course of 1 week. Now, many times, we found lots of stuff, and many times the topic would stretch into 2 weeks. But I found the mentality of the students, they couldn't carry the concept greater than 2 weeks. So 2 weeks was about as far as we would go. And then once again, we're pertinent to whatever's going on at that time of year. Page 27 of my book, I list all the topics that we did for the entire school year. And like I said, it was 30 different topics that I developed in the course of my teaching. On the second topic we would do in September was raptors. We have in Duluth, we have Hawk Ridge where there is a raptor flight.
Right.
And so it's 15 minutes from school. So we would take a quick trip there and do some counting. And then that's followed by fall wildflowers. Fall wildflowers is another topic that often gets overlooked.
For sure.
And part of that is because so many of them are non-native plants, but there's a lot of native plants too. So then we look at deciduous trees, which is often seen in autumn. Then we would talk about insects and spiders. Now, the reason I chose insects and spiders at that time is because the insects that are around by the time you get to October are insects that are either going to die or hibernate. And there's a lot of insects you're not going to be seeing, but you still see some. And then, of course, there's always going to be some spiders as well. We had a pond about a quarter mile from school, and we would walk there three times in the year. One of them was fall, another one winter, another one spring. Anyway, you see how it works out. Everything in the entire school year, we were able to go through looking at topics of what was going on. Once the snow started to cover the ground, I thought we had just a gold mine. I have often been amazed at how many teachers don't take advantage of that. It is just great. Every day there are messages written in the snow.
Indeed.
Every day. And, you know, we get out there for perhaps a half hour or more, and we see what's going on then. We are not out there the other 23 and a half hours, but somebody else is, and they leave their messages. And we did a lot of looking at tracks once the snow was on the ground. But anyway, it goes on and on like that. The entire school year was all divided into these different topics.
I know I would have been a very happy student in your class.
Well, I hope so. The students liked the walks. They called them web walks, and they liked them. Even when the weather conditions were inclement, that was okay with them. They wanted to go outside. And I remember one day we had a temperature, now this is in the Fahrenheit scale, but we had the temperature slightly above zero, and it was pretty chilly. We also had deep snow to go through, and so it was a pretty tough walk. And one of the students comes up to me afterwards, and she says, that was the greatest web walk we had all year. You know, so they accepted it.
They're more resilient than we think.
Yeah, exactly.
There's still plenty of snow on the ground as winter gives way to early spring. tracks in the snow are plenty, and the first few birds have begun to lend their voices to the beginnings of a dawn chorus.
You write in the book that you have at times been criticized for not teaching to state standards. What was your typical response to that?
Well, I could easily give a cop-out by saying I taught at a private school and standards were not held over us.
Right.
However, we had other standards at a private school that's so-called college prep. They thought I should be teaching more cellular biology as an example of being more college prep. And I admitted that, yeah, when I'm taking students outside and I'm showing them mushrooms and animal tracks and so forth, there's not going to be a lot of questions on their, on their exam for getting a scholarship to college. There's not going to be a lot of questions about that. But I believe what I was teaching may not be college prep, but it is life prep. And it's the kind of thing that sticks with you. You see something and you remember it.
And I think part of it is cultural, because it's just been so undervalued in contemporary society, at least in our part of the world. Why do you think that is? I mean, why has nearby nature sort of just become wallpaper that's there that we don't spend as much time looking at?
You know, that's a hard question to answer, but I will try to answer it in a couple of ways. Number one, nature itself, going out to see nature for its own sake. They seem by only nature nerds or nature freaks. It doesn't seem to be a regular thing that families will do. If they're going to get into nature, the idea is either it's going to be some other place or some other time. There is nothing going on in nature around my house, that kind of attitude. I attended a talk at a teacher conference one time where the person giving the talk had sent a questionnaire to teachers about what kind of places would you want to take your students to. They range from totally urban to totally wilderness. Number one on the list was state parks or provincial parks. And I understand that. That's where I take the students often.
Yeah.
I understand that. That was no surprise. Number last on the list was a surprise. It was the campus itself that they wouldn't bother to take students outside. They don't think there's anything there. And so if I have to give some suggestions to teachers about taking students outside, is number one, get to know your own campus. And with costs of traveling and gasoline and so forth going up, stepping outside the door and walking around is a good alternative.
It's amazing what kind of diversity is even on a lawn. I mean, if it's overly manicured, it might be a monoculture, but if it hasn't been completely manicured, there's a tremendous variety of plant species and insect species that you can find on a pretty standard lawn.
Oh, yes. Yep, I agree with you.
Yeah.
On the cusp of spring leaf out, the dawn chorus has swelled noticeably, and wildflowers like trilliums and violets are abundant in hardwood forests.
So in terms of tools and resources for teaching phenology-based science, what would you recommend? I mean, your book, of course, but in addition to that?
Probably just taking time to look. And I carry a notebook with me all the time. Now, many people have smartphones, but that's okay. And keep records of what you see. That's a pretty powerful topic, pretty powerful thing. And just getting out regularly to take a look. Regularly doesn't mean once a month. It means a lot more than that. I believe in daily. Now, you could take students out daily, but I don't recommend it. I recommend students going out about once, maybe twice a week. However, the teacher could go out themselves on a regular basis. I list in the book 10 different suggestions about how to teach phenology-based science. And one of them is that you learn along with your students. Nobody's going to know everything. I have had teacher conference where teachers have said to me, I would love to take my students outside, but I don't know what's going on out there. And I would say back to them, well, learn along with your students. And you don't have to hang a name on everything. If you see something, and if it looks like a little brown bug, well, why don't you call it a little brown bug and then watch it for a while, whatever it's doing. I think that's what it's really all about, is learning to watch and appreciate nature that's nearby.
Yeah. And in terms of record keeping, I know you wrote in your book that you've been keeping records consistently for decades. I mean, you must have just a tremendous resource bank of data.
Yeah, you want to do something with them? I'm getting a lot of them. My wife thinks I got to do something with them. Yes, I started keeping a daily nature journal on January 1, 1975.
Wow.
That's not a misprint, 1975. And I have never missed a day.
That's both inspiring and instructive. And I'm envious.
But it's also frustrating. I don't tell that when I give teacher conferences. I don't tell that to the teachers. I think they feel like, oh my gosh, I can't do anything like that. No, I just tell them, keep your own records and do it as much as you want or as little as you want. It should be enjoyable. If you feel like it's something, a chore that you have to do, then you're missing the idea.
Yeah. And in terms of being able to keep records with a class, I know you mentioned in the book having your first and last lists for things like blooming, yes, of wildflowers or arrivals or departures of migratory birds and, yes, all of those sorts of signals. I mean, that is very doable, even if it's just at a basic scale like the first robin of the year or the first song sparrow heard singing or the first trillium blooming.
Yeah. Or during a walk in an urban area, something like, when do you see the grass green? When do you see somebody out mowing a lawn? You know, things like that. As I said, we live phenology a lot more than we think we do.
We do. Well, any final thoughts or advice for listeners?
Yeah, get out and see nature.
It's as simple as that.
Yeah, I can't think of a negative thing about nature. Now, there's a lot of people who do. But don't ask me about that. I don't see anything negative about nature. I see it extremely positive. I was giving a walk with a local TV station cameraman one day out in a field where there was lots of spiders. And we were chatting about it. And I was saying, oh, look at this and this and this and this. And finally, he says, can you ever say anything bad about spiders? And I said, no, I cannot. There's nothing bad about spiders. They are misunderstood, but they're just outstanding animals, as is many things of nature.
Well, you've certainly helped me learn a lot more about spiders, and I thank you for that. And I thank you for your time today in having this discussion about phenology. I'm inspired to go for a walk in my local area and look for some signs, whatever they may be.
Well, another suggestion I would give is I do a daily walk every morning. And to me, that's the way to really experience the morning. There's always something that's going to be happening. And it might be, usually it's small, but sometimes it's rather large and significant. And of course, not everybody lives the kind of place I do, but nevertheless, there are things to see.
There always are. Well, thank you so much for your time, Larry, and sharing your stories. And for the books, I hope there are many more to come.
Well, we'll see. I agree with, but my publisher is a little bit slow. So anyway, okay, thank you.
Come midsummer, evening walks are quieter as the breeding season for most birds winds to a close. Crickets and katydids are becoming more noticeable, and the last few fireflies are still dazzling with their bioluminescence. There's even a chance of glimpsing the first signs of autumn with the blooming of an early goldenrod, the first species of goldenrod to bloom each year in the North Woods. Talking with Green Teachers is co-hosted by Ian Shanahan and me, Sofia Vargas-Nesi. Ian is the show's writer and editor. Logo design is by Devin Terrien. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or iTunes to get instant access to each new episode. If you really like the show, give us a rating too. We can also be found wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for joining us in this episode. We'll chat again soon.